The following presentation was recorded at a teacher's workshop at Faith Builders. More information on Faith Builders events at fbep.org.
Foam and fumed over the scent and over the table. The air in the neighborhood of the performance became color dark red. A great colored cloud arose. This was disagreeable and suffocating. How should I stop this? I tried to get rid of the objectionable mass by picking it up and throwing it out the window. I learned another fact. Nitric acid not only acts upon copper, but it acts upon fingers. The pain led to another unpremeditated experiment. I drew my fingers across my trousers, and another fact was discovered. Nitric acid acts upon trousers. Taking everything into consideration, that was the most impressive experiment, and relatively probably the most costly experiment I have ever performed. It was a revelation to me. It resulted in a desire on my part to learn more about that remarkable kind of action. Plainly, the only way to learn about it was to see its results, to experiment, to work in the laboratory.
Thank you, Patrick. Patrick's one of my co-teachers there at school at Barnwell, and he's been a big help already this weekend, and he'll continue to give some help as we go through this morning. Felt it might be of value to talk a little bit about why I became interested in science. And it started at a fairly early age, probably when I walked into the fourth grade classroom and the teacher there had a bunch of test tubes and chemicals laying around. And I thought, wow, this is interesting. And from then on, I've been very fascinated. Now, fortunately, the school where I went, it worked out good for me. They had a lot of chemicals and test tubes, but they didn't use them. And so they didn't mind if I'd come and say, hey, you know, I'd really like some silver nitrate. And so the teacher would be, sure, here we have some. Why don't you take it with you? So we started a lab at my house. Now, my mother is a very exacting housekeeper, which could have put an end to my interests, but fortunately we had a basement. And so I was able to make a lab in the basement of our house, and she still tells about the pops and bangs and the sounds coming from there. But the reason I needed silver nitrate was because I had started doing playing around with electroplating, and I was using copper sulfate and plating copper. I was using lead nitrate and plating lead, just using a simple battery and 6-volt battery and running it through a solution. Had some plates, metal plates that would stick down in it. And I was coming up with ways where I could get the lead to kind of float off of it, and I'd collect that. And I was thinking about going into the business. And but, you know, I thought, boy, wouldn't it be great if instead of copper or lead, we could plate silver. Now, then we could really do something. Now, I didn't consider where I was going to get all this silver after the supply at school ran out. But anyway, they donated some silver nitrate to me. I took this home, and my lab was already, I had a lab table about yay big, and it was already full of stuff that particular day. So I decided to move the scene of operations over to the freezer. We had a nice freezer in the basement as well, and so I set up on top of the freezer, and was having a great time putting the silver nitrate in there and getting it all set up, and I started getting some silver off of it, and I was excited. And at the same time, my father just purchased a small motorcycle, and so to run off the excitement, I decided to go out and take a ride on the motorcycle. So I did that, and I come back in, and I was playing around in the stuff some more, and I had my hands down in the solution, and I spilled some across the freezer. Still no problem yet that I knew of. And I went out, and I took another ride on the motorcycle, and I started noticing that my hands were starting to turn funny. They were starting to kind of shrink. Now, they weren't getting smaller in size, but the skin was shrinking. Plus, the color was unusual. And so it went about a half an hour later. By that time, my hands were completely black, and also nice splotches on the freezer were black, top running down the side. But, oh no, now what's my mother going to do? Well, I couldn't quite figure out what was going on. I thought maybe I had gotten into some grease or something on the motorcycle, but I went out and I put gasoline on my hands. That didn't take care of it. Put diesel fuel on my hands. That didn't take care of it. Put alcohol on my hands. That didn't take care of it. And they were continually getting tighter and tighter the whole time. And I was starting to get a little worried, but I didn't really want to confess this to my parents yet because I wanted to be able to explain what had gone wrong. And so I went up to the set of encyclopedias and looked up silver nitrate, and I discovered the fact. Silver nitrate does turn flesh black or dark brown and other things as well. So I had to go to church that next, I believe that was a Saturday, and that Sunday I had to go to church with black hands, and I still remember the stares and the questions. It took several days before that wore off. But science is fascinating. Even that type of experience can be so interesting for us, even though it wasn't exactly painless. What I'd like to do this morning is talk about some methods, some ways that we can teach the physical sciences. Now, that's what I generally teach, and so I'm going to limit a lot of my comments to teaching the physical sciences, primarily chemistry and physics, or an introduction to those. And some of you say, well, I teach in the elementary and I don't teach chemistry or physics. And I guarantee you it's shot through just about every textbook you have in first through sixth grade, some form of chemistry or physics. And so hopefully this will be useful for you. Now, I want to, the outline for the talk this morning is in six areas. And I will, you don't need to worry about getting these down if you're taking notes, because we'll go back through them. Those of you who were here last evening will recognize these 6 points, but I want to go into detail as to how these are useful in teaching the physical sciences. So first of all, we will begin with drilling the significant terms and factual information. It is imperative. I'll say this again. It is imperative that you as a teacher figure out what the significant information is that you need to teach. That's sometimes called the core knowledge. The absolutely essentials of the course that you're teaching that you want your students to know for all time. You want to be able to go back to them when they're 65 and say, can you give me the definition of entropy? And they can still give it to you. So drill the significant information. Your task is to identify what that significant information is. And once more, let me just point out this is a resource I didn't mention last evening. I believe it's in the library down here. A number of you have probably seen this book. It's called Teaching Children, Curriculum Guide to What Children Need to Know at Each Level Through Sixth Grade. So for the elementary teachers, it's very useful for pulling out core knowledge. So our students need to know these terms. They need to know these concepts. So identify what that core knowledge is. Once you have identified that information, then it's important for you to put that information into a course objective form. And I would like to speak about this just a little bit. As you write your objectives for your class, you know what you want to teach. Now you're going to put that into an objective form, and there's a couple guidelines here that are useful. First of all, they need to be written in terms of student achievement. You should not write your objectives, I am going to do a lot of demonstrations. That's not a good objective. Your objectives need to be in the form, the student will be able to. After this course is finished, after this week, after today, my student will be able to do this, do this, do this, and do this. So you know what you want to teach. And now you're putting it in the form of what your students are going to be able to do. The reason you want to do that is so you'll be able to check it. You see, if you write your objectives, the student will be able to define entropy. Then at the end of the day, you can see, you can give them a little quiz. Break down the definition of entropy for me. You can see if your objective is accomplished or not. It is also important as you're writing objectives that they be measurable. You need to be able to measure your objectives. So not just the student will be able to, but the student will be able to list 5 steps of the scientific method. See, that's measurable. You can see if that is actually taking place or not. And then the third thing I would suggest as we think about writing course objectives is that you should write objectives that include all levels of thinking skills. Not just they will be able to know something, but they will be able to evaluate which is the best choice. They will be able to analyze why something happened, and so on. So you want to be, you don't want to just keep your instruction on the knowledge level. They'll be able to define or list, but move them up through the levels of learning. I would suggest that as you identify the core knowledge, as you, whether it's for the whole year or whether it's for one unit, that you teach that early into the unit. Maybe you have 10 days to work on a particular chapter of information. Try in the first day or two to introduce all of the core knowledge and then use the rest of the time to drill it and come back and hit it different ways and illustrate it and demo it and lab it. Teach the core early and then review it often. In physical science, I know there's a number of rather difficult concepts, and the students don't get them the first time. You have to keep coming back, keep hitting it in a different way. And so you need to give them time to absorb this core information. Once you have made sure that you've mastered the core, then you see you can use all the rest of your time to expose to everything else that's there. But it's absolutely essential that you know there's something here that I want these students to get. Don't just shotgun and say, boy, I hope they get something out of our class. No, they're going to get this out of the class, and then we're going to expose them to as much as we can. The second thing, then, that I believe is important in teaching the physical sciences in terms of methods is to demonstrate and discuss concepts. And I want to, it'd be the second point in the outline, and I want to give a number of guidelines for doing science demonstrations. I believe very strongly that demonstrations can be very useful in your class. So this is the second point. The first one was to drill significant terms and factual information. The second one is to demonstrate and discuss concepts. Because there's a lot of difficult concepts in the physical sciences, it is important that you demonstrate what you're talking about. Don't just talk about acceleration due to gravity. Drop something. Don't just talk about terminal velocity. Let them see it. Let them see it in action. So what guidelines can we use for our demonstrations? And by the way, let me just make this distinction. I'll talk about labs, and I'll talk about demonstrations. When I talk about demonstrations, I'm thinking of those things that you as a teacher do to show your class. There's a lot of things that can be done either as demonstrations or labs. Often, demonstrations can be more effective than a lab. But there are some things that are better to be done as a lab. You've got to learn to know when it's best to do which. But as we think of demonstrations, first of all, first guideline is to rehearse the demonstration beforehand. This is important. Now, when I have as many demonstrations as we'll do here this morning, it's a little difficult. We didn't go through them all here before. Some of them we did. But all of these I've done somewhere along the line, but I didn't necessarily do them last evening or this morning. My hand here is an illustration of the importance of doing demonstrations beforehand. It looks pretty good now, but on Tuesday, Patrick and I, we were trying a variation on an experiment that we'll do here this morning, our demonstration. And we were substituting phosphorus, red phosphorus, for sulfur in this particular demo. And I had never used red phosphorus before. And I knew that it was supposed to be a little more potent, but it was quite a bit more potent. And we were still mixing the two chemicals that we were going to act upon. And it acted upon us. It nice fireball. It was beautiful, but hand was a little too close, and it fried it rather nicely. But rehearse your demonstrations beforehand. It saves you. I was glad I didn't have to do that in front of my students, although they did get a big charge out of seeing my hand. Secondly, make sure that your demonstrations can be seen. Make sure that they're visible. Now, often I'll just let students come up around the table if it's something that's small. In a group this size, we can't do that. But make sure that your demonstrations can be seen. Now, I want to stop that just for a moment and back up. You might be asking, see, what I'm going to do this morning after, actually most of these will be done after I finish up here, but I'm not planning to use these demonstrations to teach physical science this morning. What I want to do is just give you a little idea, and some of you are very good at this kind of thing, so I hope you're not too bored, but I want to just give you an idea of some of the things that can be done. But this is just a small percentage of the wonderful demonstrations that are out there. You say, where do I get these demonstrations? Well, most of the materials that I've collected are for older grades. I do have a resource here, and it's kind of hard to get a hold of. I had to put it in a notebook because we've really used it quite a bit at our school. But the author is Tick Lean, and it's called Invitations to Science Inquiry. And there's a different page. There's a page for each demonstration that it mentions. And it gives questions, gives explanations, and these are useful in all levels of school. This is a really good experience in here. And I must say, there's some books out there on science demonstrations that are worthless. The demonstrations are frankly boring. And so you want to shop around. But there's some good ones out there as well. This is one of the best that I've found. For older teachers in junior high and high school, this one here is really good, the potpourri of physics teaching ideas. If you're on a budget, you can use string and sticky tape experiments. And I think just about everyone here uses string and sticky tape and styrofoam cups, and that's about it. It's incredible the kinds of experiments that can be done with that. There's another one called a Demonstration Handbook of Physics. There is a set of books that you can get on chemical demonstrations, and a lot of the chemical demonstrations we do this morning come from this set of books. Now, they're expensive. This set costs around $100 for four of them, but there's wonderful experiments and demonstrations in here. Go to a teacher supply store, and you'll see a lot of other ones, but be sure that you look through them and make sure that there's something in there that's going to be useful for you. Something that is attention-grabbing. I suggest, what I like to do in my classes is begin every class day with a demonstration. And that's not always easy. But you come to class and you do something. And it doesn't always have to be something that blows up, although a couple of them are nice. But that doesn't need to be all the time. But if you try to make an effort that every day I'm going to have something hands-on or something that the students can see us doing together. One form of demonstration that can be very useful is the class-wide demonstration, where everybody gets involved. And we have a fairly big group here. But I tell you, I think maybe we'll just try this a little bit.
Like everybody that has sheet paper. One of the class-wide demos that we did last year, actually it wasn't a demo, it was an investigation. Y'all want this thing too? You probably seen these snap pops that you can take and throw down on the ground and then blow up on it. Just brought a pack of those in, gave all the students lunch, and I'll figure out why they were back. So they carefully opened these things up, and didn't you know, I didn't know what they were about. They found one little piece of, if you've ever opened them up, you know, some grains in there. And there was one little piece that was spongy. They kind of, that was the one that made it go. Everything else was just like a little rock. There was one spongy piece. You take the spongy piece out, and it wouldn't go. What I'd like for you to do is take your paper and begin to fold, hold it landscape, begin to fold it about a half an inch down, like that, okay? About a half an inch down, and then continue to make that fold. Continue to make that fold until you're about halfway through your paper, something like that. And then you want to begin to kind of bend it in. So move along the top and bend it in. Once you're able to kind of bend around, stick the one end into the other, something like that. Make yourself a little cylinder. Now, you can need a little piece of tape. Let's try to pass that around. So a little piece of tape so that you can tape up your sides and keep them together. Something like that. There aren't any more rolls of tape. Once you have it, just work it, have a nice front edge. Now what we've done here is make a flying machine. And we will, there's a variety of ways to fly it. And you can take it like this and give it a toss and it'll fly. Or you can hold it in your hand and fly it like this. And so once we, what I'd like to do is just give you the freedom to stand up and fly your machine. I know the tape is completely around you. Those of you on the front row, if you want to get up and give your flying machine a try. The rest of you go ahead and join in. Try different ways of flying. You want the heavy end front. That's the Thank you.
Discussion on Bernoulli's law, or to talk about aerodynamics. This particular one, I haven't figured out all that's going on in this one.
But let me tell you, it's a great discussion start that you can then move on to airflow, aerodynamics, and so on.
So think of ways that you can get your whole class involved in a demonstration. Sometimes, instead of a demonstration, we'll come and have a discussion on something that is of real interest to them. Like one time, one thing I often like to do in a physical science class is ask them, what is your, after we're working on a unit on motion, what's your velocity? What's your velocity this morning? 0 kilometers per second.
Oh, really?
Is that really what your velocity is right now?
Then we begin to think about the fact that we are actually going around, we are rotating around our axis, and we're doing that every 24 hours. And since the circumference of the Earth is around 25,000 miles, round that back to 24,000 to make this calculation simple, what are we doing? 1,000 miles an hour, just that much. And then do the calculations with the fact that we are going around the sun in 365 days, and the distance to the sun is 93 million miles. Use your circumference formula to figure out what the distance is around there. Run it into 365 days, convert that to hours, and you've got some real motion happening. And then, if you really want to do something, talk about how we're moving around in the Milky Way galaxy. And after a while, your students start getting nausea.
Well, as we continue, guidelines for these demonstrations. Third thing I would suggest is that use demonstrations sometimes as a tie-in for your lab. Things were getting a little heavy in our energy section last year. We were looking at energy. And so for the demonstration one morning, I just brought a candy bar and asked the students, who would like to eat this candy bar? Volunteers. And well, there was a number of them. Yeah. But Mr. Brubaker, if we eat it, what do we have to do? Well, I said, all I'm asking, it's really pretty simple. You don't have to do anything to get the candy bar other than just agree to work off the energy that you consume. And, well, that didn't, can't be that much energy in a candy bar. And so I said, look, I really don't want to do this to y'all. I don't want to persecute you in this way. Is it? The way I asked them to work off the energy was to run up. We have a flight of stairs that goes up to the balcony in our church. And I asked them, you'll run it off by climbing that flight of stairs, coming back down, doing it again. And I said, I really don't want to ask somebody to do that for a whole candy bar. I said, tell you what, there was a number. I said, could I have 8 of you? And so there were 8 volunteers. I said, we'll split this candy bar up into 8 pieces. And then do you agree to work off the energy? They said, yeah, fine. We did the calculations. And if I remember correctly, they had to run up the stairs about 60 times in order to work off that 1/8 of a candy bar. Well, we also turned that into a, I had them time them running up and down to see who could do it the fastest. And so we had some nice data for our velocity labs as well. But use that demonstration kind of as a tie-in to what you want to do as a lab. And that's what we did. We used that then as a lab. The next guideline is keep your demonstration simple. And you know, there's room for elaborate demonstrations, but you don't have to have elaborate demonstration. Probably the most useful piece of equipment that I have in our lab are tennis balls. Now, I must admit that these are not just regular tennis balls. This one is not. But they look like regular tennis balls, and they can be useful for a lot of things. But, see, that was not regular.
And you can tell it doesn't feel quite permanent. Get that back up.
It's BBs in here. How long did we do it this summer? How long did it take to fill one of these with BBs? It takes a while, but it's very useful. So, very simple piece of equipment. Use this for talking about density. Same mass, or the same size, excuse me, the same volume that it takes up, but the mass is quite a bit different. And so one has a greater density than the other. We use it for talking about acceleration of falling bodies. And it doesn't matter. This is another thing students don't really like at first, is that it doesn't matter what the mass is. They both accelerate at the same rate. Well, let's just take a look at this and see. What I often do is have our students go up to the top of our church. We have a point about 30 feet up. I have a student who gets up there and will drop these so that we can see that they definitely do hit the ground at the same time. I don't know if you'll be able to, but Patrick, if you try to drop them at the same time, you can see that they stay right beside them. Weight does not make a difference.
These can be used in a variety of things. Another one
is the transfer of momentum. If you take your finger and figure that that's the same type of force, we'll put that force there, that force there. I've transferred the same force to both, but the momentum or the effect of momentum on each is different. This is a greater mass, this velocity is less than one with less mass.
So simple things are great. A lot of what we do here this morning is simple stuff. Now, there are some chemicals that can cost you some money. By the way, when you get up on top of the roof of the church, one of the other things I like to do, take a bucket with a hole poked in the side, fill the thing up with water, and have the students set up there and hold it for a while. The water will be coming out. As soon as they drop it, the water will stop because the water becomes weightless as it begins to fall. One of the students asked me this year, it was good, they said, well, really, you wouldn't have to have a bottom on the bucket, would you? And if you dropped it, you know, if you had it, that the water wouldn't come out. Well, they're absolutely right. The problem is how you would pour the water in and drop it. But when you do a demonstration, you have a specific concept that you want to communicate. I've found it's very easy for students to remember the demonstration and for, what was it we were supposed to learn from that? Okay, so you got to keep your concept fairly simple. Meter sticks, another one of the most useful pieces of equipment in the physical science lab.
Now, one of the things I kind of like to do is to come in class, something like this, and I try to be very technical. Now, my left hand is on the 2-centimeter mark, and my right hand is on the 76-centimeter mark. Now, I'm planning to bring my hands together, and I'll move my hands both in. I'll put pressure on both hands and move them. And I ask the students, where will my hands meet up? Now, when I see them start calculating, 76 minus 2 divided by 2, then I know that I've got it.
and they'll come up and they'll say something. Oh, we think maybe about 34, 36, somewhere there. Okay, well, let's give it a shot. So we begin to move together. I'm trying to move both hands. Right at 50. The weight of an object operates at its center of mass. The center of mass of an object like this is at the center. So my hands will always move. Doesn't matter where I start them. My hands will always move and land up in the center because that's where the weight of this object is acting. One idea
to a demonstration. Be dramatic. It's okay. I mentioned to someone that I feel like I've taught a lot of physical science this year from on top of my desk. What it gets your students' attention if you're up on top there, but then it's also a great place for dropping things and so on. It's okay to be dramatic. And, you know, students do enjoy when you
Now, as we're talking about center of mass, center of mass has an awful lot to do with balancing. And so if I take this coat hanger we've been here a particular way, and I try to put it on my hand, it doesn't want to balance. Now, if we could consider where the center of gravity of this object is, it's going to be fairly high, and that wants to tip over, okay? And so, it doesn't balance well. What we'll do is take just some clay, and we'll add it to the ends of our hanger. And what this will do is lower the center of gravity of this object, so that it's below the balancing point. And now, balance it very nicely. And we can put it up on top of a meter stick, whatever, it balances, no problem. Even better than that. Seems like to see that. Be dramatic.
Think big. I found this is very useful as you are doing different demonstrations and so on. Often when you read a demonstration in a book, it'll be dealing with little things. Just make it bigger. It's much better. Now there's one big thing we haven't done yet, but I'm anxious. One of the demonstrations we'll do here is a collapsing can, and many of you have probably seen that. You can take a paint can, put a little water in it, heat it up, put the lid on, cool the can, and the whole thing will shrink. But what if you would use a 55-gallon drum? Wouldn't that be great? We haven't done that yet, but we're waiting for the opportunity. But think big. Now, if you were to get one of your science catalogs out, you would find that you could purchase a little device that had three balls on it. And those balls, it's called Nina balls. You may have seen it. It'll run you about $65 purchase. I found that you can do the same thing with a golf ball and ping pong ball. And I didn't bring a golf ball with me. We'll try it with this. So if we take a ball, see it's not bouncing very good. It looks about how high it bounces. We'll take that ping pong ball and bounce it. Now, if we were to take the two together, and do it, you get a lot bigger bounce.
Now, that's the way, the one that you pay $65 for. Now, actually, they have a little rod through it so you can hold it and drop it, and it will shoot straight up. You can get this one to shoot straight up as well. You get a lot better bounce. The thing is, why stop with that? Why not get bigger balls to do it with? Now, take a basketball. You see about how much it bounces. As you're doing your demonstrations, don't just do the small ones, or you do it with small things. Try big things. It's very effective when you're doing demonstrations to ask your students, what's going to happen? Particularly in physics type demonstrations. What's going to happen? Now, I have a stack of blocks here, and I don't know if you can see, but underneath this stack of blocks is a piece of paper, and with this piece of paper is a little string that I can use to pull with. And so I ask the students, well, I ask you, if I pull on that piece of paper, which way will the stacks fall? You can predict what will happen. Somebody give me a response. Which way do you think about it?
Your car doesn't stay standing.
Okay, we have a gentleman here that says it'll stay standing. Are there any other predictions?
What are the options?
Give me that. It'll fall this way. Okay, what else? Any other options? Stay standing, fall backwards. Anybody falling forwards? Yeah. Actually, you can do either win the one you want. And all three of them illustrate some principles, particularly of Newton's first law. And so we'll see if we could get the three to work. Now, I'm not sure if it'll work, but I'm nervous. But we'll first of all try to get it to fall forward. Now we'll try to get it to fall backwards. And finally, we will try to get it to stay standing. Now Newton's first law tells us that an object wants to maintain a constant velocity. Since its velocity is zero, it really wants to maintain a zero velocity. Have students predict what will happen. I like that one because it doesn't really matter what they predict, you can get it to do something else. It's good also to have opposing viewpoints explain why. that you get. I love it when other someone sees it. This is going to happen. Another one says, no, this is going to happen. Another one says, this is going to happen. And you say, why? Why? You defend your answer, you defend yours, you defend yours. Great learning.
Also suggest that you repeat your demonstrations a number of times with variations.
Now, just the other day, we were working with this conservation momentum concept, and one of the students said, what would happen? Why don't you just try different types of balls? And so we did. So we tried a ping pong ball and a basketball. And I was surprised at what happened. Now, I don't know if it'll do the same with this or not, but let's see what takes place. Does with a golf ball, but it doesn't with it. Now, why is that? Again, so we tried it with variations. We got a whole bunch of balls. We were just doing all kinds of different possibilities and trying to figure them out.
Ran across a quote recently that really sums up. No, it doesn't. but it's interesting. On demonstrations. The way to capture a student's attention is with a demonstration where there is a possibility the teacher may die. I think that should be a creed. I understand that the person who wrote that, who said that, was in the hospital twice from demonstrations that he did. We'll get back to some more demonstrations after a while. But for right now, I'd like to continue on with our thoughts about how we teach methods of teaching the physical sciences. And we're ready for our third point, which is we need to get our students to investigate problems. We need to drill the significant facts, terms. We need to demonstrate and discuss concepts. We need to investigate problems. And what I mean by a problem here is something that, well, is this really the way it is? We talked about some last evening. The one about does freezing a candle increase its light? See, that's a problem that we can investigate, that the students can investigate. Here is a chance for your students to learn the scientific method, to apply that. One that has really worked well for us in the past is the question, what is the lung capacity of an average teenager? What's the lung capacity? And they have to design a way to measure your lung capacity, and then they start asking questions. We take that problem and we go on with it, and we'll say, but maybe does it have anything to do, your lung capacity, does it have anything to do with how long you can hold your breath? You know, the people that can hold their breath for a long time, are they going to have bigger lungs or not? And so we'll study, we'll try to answer that question. Or maybe it has something to do with your age. Maybe your lung capacity has a lot, if you're an adult, you have a lot bigger lungs than if you're 10. So we'll investigate that. Maybe it has something to do with your size. These are problems that you can get your students to investigating. A good resource that I ran across just recently for that is this book. It's put out by Dover Publications, Science Research Experiments for Young People. And what this has is a whole bunch of questions like that in. And it gives ideas for how to figure out the answers to those questions. Do questions like, if you have older students, you know, what is the circumference? Or what is the diameter of the earth? What could we do to figure that out? So get them investigating problems. Teach them then how to investigate the problems with the scientific method, and then how to report on their conclusions. I was going to bring a copy of a lab report that I generally give out. I give a model lab report to the students saying, this is what I expect to see. I want this kind of quality. They need to be typed. I want to see graphs when appropriate, tables. I want to see well-written conclusions and so on. So I give them a model of what it is, and that's helped them quite a bit to be able to come up with good lab reports. But that is one type of lab. There's really two types of labs that you can do. The one is this investigating problem, and that's what I'll do. Just put a question on the board, say, go solve it. Figure it out. Apply the scientific method to it, figure it out. But there is another type of lab, and that is useful when we're practicing skills. Sometimes they need guidance. Maybe they need to figure out the variables that affect the period of a pendulum. And in something like that, it's probably good to have a little more directed lab where they are practicing measurement skills and so on. By the way, that's something that is a good thing for you to do, is begin your school year, begin your course with some labs where what they have to do is do measurements. One of the favorites in the high school is when I've put them into groups when we're working with measuring speed, velocity, distance, so on. I get out on the road in a van, and I will drive past three times where they are. They can spread out over a little distance. And so I'm going to be driving past, and I'm going to be going a particular speed. And so you can bank, it's going to be going over 0 miles per hour, and it's going to be less than 55. So if your answer is something other than that, you know you're wrong. But anyway, they need to come in their groups. They have to figure out how fast I'm going. And you see, that makes a good lab because they can check their results with a definite answer. They get kind of competitive on this thing, and they want to be sure that they get the right answer and not the other group. Or at least they get it if the other group gets it. So they get out there and they try hard to get their distances right and get their timing right. And then so they figure it all up, have to do the unit conversions. You know, generally they're going to be measuring in feet. I do that. That's the one lab I do in English units. But I come back and I'll tell them that I'm going. You know, they tell me, well, we think you're going 48. Another group says 46, and one might say 40. Well, I was going 45. You see, they can verify how close that they were. One year, I think it was 2 years ago when we did this, every group got it within like 5/10 of the right answers. It's the first time that had happened. Generally, they're a couple miles off. But practice your skills. Give your students a chance. Have a science-rich environment in your classroom. There's some of this stuff here, like the Cartesian diver there, that you can just have around. The students could like to play with and try different things. That's the bottle with the medicine dropper in. Stuff like this that you can leave set up, sitting around, systems of pulleys, on and on, gives them a chance to play around with it and develop some of their skills. I probably should say a little something about the kind of equipment that you need to have in your lab or in your classroom in order to do physical science right. And I don't have an exhaustive list, but one of the most important things is measuring equipment. You need lots of meter sticks and graduated cylinders, and you have to have a balance beam or some kind of scale. Calipers, a lot of measuring equipment is vital. It's probably the most vital thing that you can have. You say, well, we're on a budget and we can't get a lot of equipment. See, a lot of equipment that we have, we probably have a couple $1,000s worth of equipment, but there's most of the stuff that we use on a regular basis could be bought for under $500. And so it doesn't take, a lot of our stuff comes from the students donate it. They bring this thing that they have or that thing. And so you can get by. You'd notice a lot of the stuff up here, I mean, there are some test tubes and so on, but a lot of jars and stuff too. That works great. Okay, the fifth thing then that's important as we think about teaching the physical sciences is yourself, that you need to model the attitudes and skills that you want to see in your students.
One of the things that I really enjoy doing is teaching students how to smell. And a lot of students don't know how to smell chemicals, and they'll get something like this and just come up and take a whiff. But don't they need to waft it to them. And it's still use ammonium hydroxide concentrated, and they'll get the idea pretty quickly.
Model the kinds of attitudes and skills you do the way that you want to see them doing. Exhibit a fascination with what you're doing and with phenomena. You get excited, and it will help them too as well. Howard Hendricks said this, and it's a maxim for teachers that is so useful across the board, and that is, if you want your students to bleed, you must hemorrhage. Isn't that true? So if you want them to be excited a little bit, you've got to really be excited. If you want your students to bleed, you must hemorrhage. Sixth thing then I'll talk about a little bit is planning special events. And we talked about a number of these last evening. Just mention a couple again. One, the Science Olympics or Physics Olympics. This is something that can be adapted for most grades, and I have a handout. I don't have them all stapled, but if you're interested in the handouts, see me in the back after the session, and there's two things that I have to give you. One is a model syllabus for putting your course together, and the second thing is the outline of the Physics Olympics that we use. In the Physics Olympics that we have, we call it that. That may be a kind of an intimidating name for elementary students. Like I said, we generally have a number of events. One is the catapult throw. One is an egg drop. And the students there have to build a container to drop an egg 30 feet. And it can only use newspaper or copier type paper, anything of that weight or less, and scotch tape or a masking tape. That's all they can use. Build a container where they drop it from that height, and it doesn't bust. Now, if we have more than one that doesn't bust, and we often do, then what we have a formula, and it's on that sheet for figuring up what who has the best score. And the student that has the smallest vertical height to it gets a better score. You know, some students might want to just build a big old canister and have the egg up at the top. Of course, it's not going to fall very well. Some of them tried that, and I think, like that, and the egg hits first. That's the one thing. And then weight. We weigh them. And the one that has the lightest device. In fact, the winner this year was kind of a flying machine. It was kind of like a parachute. It was just very, very narrow, and it held the egg. It just settled the thing right down on the ground. Worked very nicely. You see a lot of different designs with that. Bridge building using popsicle sticks and white glue. And then you see who can support the most weight with the bridge. That information is on there. But there's so many different special events that you can come up with to put. Maybe you want to have a solar oven cook-off. Have the students make solar ovens to cook a hot dog. Or it may be one that you can actually measure is to have them a certain amount of water. Maybe they have 500 milliliters of water that they have to heat up. You give them 15 minutes to put that water into their oven, their solar oven, heat it up, and then you measure the temperature. Whoever has the greatest temperature change in that kind of time is the winner. Think of some special events that you can do to add interest. The way I want to end today, then, is just to go ahead and move through a number of more physics demonstrations and chemical demonstrations. Again, my purpose is not to teach physics or chemistry concepts, to give you an idea of some of the things that can be done. If I move through too fast through something and you want to get some details down that I don't give you, feel free to stop at any time. And we'll try to fill you in with what you need. What I will do is talk, is give, just name the concept
that is being taught, and then I'll
tell you,
and then go ahead and do
the experiment. First, some Bernoulli's Law.
Bernoulli's Law is best taught, my opinion, with vacuum cleaner and a ball. And you've probably seen this one time or another. You've probably seen it in your house where you have ductwork in the floor. You've probably seen some child's ball that got on top of it and sitting there floating above it. For all this ball, playing the time that takes place. It also gives you, talking about why airplanes fly and why baseballs curve.
You want to come on up, Patrick? Go ahead and get the cans.
Density. I've already talked about how you can use the two tennis balls to show density. Another great investigation of density has to do with soda cans. And we will take, these are untampered with, cans of soda. We'll take Pepsi, stick it in our water. That's what we extract. Six. Now we will take Diet Pepsi. Now, let me just point out that the volume on here, remember that density is mass over volume, mass per unit of volume. And this tells us that the volume of this is 355 milliliters. The volume of this is 355 milliliters. That's six. The Diet Pepsi floats.
Then you might get your money's worth of that Diet Pepsi.
Coke. Diet Coke. Then we'll go to the generic brands. This is RC. You're definitely not getting your money's worth. And that's Diet RC. It also flows. There's a number of things you can play around with this, but one, that's sync two of these. Watch how fast they rise. What can we deduce from that? Well, there's a number of things, and you can see the possibilities you work through your students. So density. To suggest an answer. Why is it that some float and others don't? What is it? There would be two different levels we need to answer this. First of all, the obvious thing is since the volume is the same, the mass must be different. So the mass of the diets and the RC is less. And by the way, you can take this and go in and take a balance beam. If you have a good balance beam, you can see it. It's quite a bit different. The density of the pure Pepsi is greater than water. The density of the Diet Pepsi is less than water. And what is it that causes it to be less? The closest I can come to answering that is that it is the, and I've seen this suggested, that it is the type of sugar that is used as a lower density. Of course, that's the obvious answer to that.
The type used or not used.
That's right. Type used or not used. Okay, kinetic theory of matter. Everything is made up of particles. Those particles are in motion, and the speed at which those particles are moving is what indicates the temperature
or the heat that's present. That's kinetic theory. And what we're going to do is use two different things to consider that. One is we have these Pepsi, these Coke cans, these are empty, have just a little bit of water in the bottom that we're heating up. And so what we're going to do is get those particles moving very rapidly. Now when they move rapidly, they also expand. And so the content in these cans, the air in those cans, is going to rarefy it. So there's not nearly as much volume, or there's not many, as many particles in there. The volume is the same, but the number of particles is small. So that's what we're doing at this point. We'll try to get that motion going in there, get the air rarefied. And then what we'll do is we'll take that and we'll cool it quickly, but we will cut off the hole for where the air can go back in. We'll do that by just turning it over into our water here, and we'll see what happens. Now it wants to suck water in, but it can't get the water in fast enough. And so what happens? The air pressure out here collapses in. You see, it's doing this quite a bit of water in that short time. Go ahead and take that one. You can really stick it in good. Okay, as the water cools it, then those particles begin moving much slower. They take up less volume, and that lets the air pressure push in. Now, we'll do this. Is a very similar demonstration, pretty easy to do. And we have a flask here with just a little bit of water in it. We'll keep the water up, and again, get the particles in the air here moving rapidly. So they'll take up more space, and then we will again cut it off. And we're not going to try to collapse this flask.
While that's warming up, maybe I'll move on and talk about one other thing.
Density again here, but also Pascal's law that the pressure applied to a fluid is the same constant throughout. It's just a 2-liter bottle with just plain water in it. Here's a medicine dropper that also has a little bit of water in it. That's the trick, is getting the right amount of water in that. But as we apply pressure to the outside of the bottle, according to Pascal's law, that pressure gets transferred inside. So we have the Cartesian diver. Now, why is he diving? Well, you'll notice, I don't know if you can see, but you'll notice that as I squeeze on air, the water level on the dropper gets higher. Therefore, the density of the dropper goes up, and the dropper falls. So the density of the dropper becomes greater than that of water, and it drops to the bottom. Okay. Now you see, apparently we had a little impurity in our water, and it's turned red on us because there was a little bit of base. Put the stopper on. Found.
moving on to sound. This is one of the most intriguing pieces of sound apparatus in my lab. Called Big Ben. And it's just a plain old ordinary Kodak cut and ticker fact. Has great, great sound to it. Now, I need a volunteer to come up. Somebody that has never heard this. Somebody else. Okay, what I want you to do, Glenn, is take is put it over your head and stick the tray in your ear. This is actually this. Why don't you turn around and face it? Not that you'll see much, but or hear much actually. Actually, this is a front. This is the way I do earwax collections. Hear, big man? Okay, now all of you will have to experience it to understand what you heard. And so we'll have this up here. But it's quite a difference if you hear. Now also with sound, it's kind of nice to have sound too. You can pick up you can use a lot of different ones. This one happens to be from a stuffy body's video. But you, any type of hose that has the corrugations like this, it's great for producing sound. I know a number of you that were here this summer had fire hose. But you not only get, you can get a number of different tones. To the physics of that, but it's a great way to introduce it. It's kind of nice to have these hemispheres for use in demonstrating air pressure. When you know that there really isn't such a thing as a vacuum, that there is actually. Vacuum is nothing more than the absence of air, and so when something collapses because of the vacuum, it's because of air pressure pushing in on it, not that there's something inside sucking. Now, air pressure is very, very strong, as you can see with these. And I just put a little water on it to increase. But as we push it onto something like a chair, and we push it down, what it does, all that air in there is evacuated, so now we have this column of air pushing down on it. So it's a tremendous amount of pressure that we have. These you can use a plunger just as well, or something like that. These are a little more convenient, perhaps. Okay, I need now, David, maybe if you would come up, and Richard, you can come up. And I'd like for you to get on either end of this road here. I'm sorry. If you're teaching high school physical science or physics, you know that you need to worry about, or one of the things that you have to teach, it's kind of tough, is vectors, vector forces, and how that, if I want to move this table in that direction, my best shot is to push on it directly. Now, if I push on it at an angle, not all of the force will be in that direction, but there will be some. And for a diagonal force, you have both a horizontal and vertical component. So I won't get into that much further, but one of the ways I would like to demonstrate that is by having two fellas pull on a rope. Now, if y'all would go ahead and pull, this is not tug of war, okay? Your point is not to pull each other back and forth. Your point is to keep this rope off the floor. Okay? So you can pull as hard as you want. Now, Patrick, if you would just go in the center and see if you could put the rope down. Come on. Okay, I'll tell you what. Let's go ahead. This is risky. Why don't you two come up and join? Now, you see, very little of the force that they're putting out on is actually being used to pull up on that rope. Most of the force is in that direction. Okay, Peg, now you got a little challenge on that. They're in a trap. Okay. Step on it once. Make sure, I want to see the rope on the ground. Come on, you guys. Okay, thank you very much. This is a great way to bring a little bit of, to reduce the pride of some of your stronger fellows. You may want to have a broom, something like this. And this one I don't have fixed up quite right yet, but it works very well. What you do is you want to cut the broom where it balances. But the question is, this is the point at which the broom balances. That is the center of mass of this broom. Then you ask the question, which side of the broom, right here for balance, which side weighs the most? Almost always your answer will be, well, they balance, they weigh the same. That's not right. You can take it apart and you can weigh the two. You'll find that this weighs more. Why? Because of torque. This one has a lot longer distance out here, and so it needs less mass in order to balance off this end. Another simple way that you could use to show or talk about acceleration due to gravity. Now we know that all objects fall at 9.8 meters per second squared neglecting air pressure. And when you're talking about something that is falling through air, you want to demonstrate that it's something heavy like a book. It will fall at that, for the most part, that acceleration falls like a rock. You also want to introduce the concept of terminal velocity due to air friction. So if you drop a piece of paper, see it drops much slower. Isn't it dropping 9.8 meters per second squared? No. Why don't you say that all things drop at the same acceleration? That's neglecting air friction. And so what we can do is put the two together and drop them together. The book will clear everything out. And the paper, once more, drops like a rock. Let's go ahead then and get started on some of the chemical demonstrations. One of the things you'll work with a lot in chemistry on whatever level are acids and bases. And this is just kind of a human interest type of thing. All we'll do is have some water here. We'll pour it into our three cups. We get water again. This is a case of a demonstration going awry. We'll have to make some modifications here. Why? acids and bases. We're using, we should have, phenolphthalein red, and acid turns it clear. Just a simple little way of kind of introducing it. And what's much better is the use of titration. When you get the point where it moves from an acid to a base, right on that point, we tried this, and I hope we did this last evening, I hope it's still present. But this is a mixture where we've completely neutralized an acid using a base. Now what we've used in this case, it's sulfuric acid, and we use sodium hydroxide as the base. We've got it right to the point where it has become a salt. This here is acid, this is base, and so if we take and put a base in, it will turn red. If we put an acid in, it will clear up. We're right at the point where it switches back and forth. Theoretically, if you use hydrochloric acid and sodium hydroxide, hydrochloric acid, you know, that's what you use between the concrete off your bricks, and sodium hydroxide is red devil lye, and you can use it to clean out your drains. Those two substances, very corrosive, very deadly, when mixed together, actually neutralize to form table salt and water. And so if you did this right, you could actually drink it in salt water and it'd be okay, but don't recommend it. Okay, so that is neutralization, titration. Next thing, we'll look at gas production. There's a variety of gases that you can make in the lab, and one that's very simple, everybody can do, is carbon dioxide. And we'll make some carbon dioxide using just basic baking soda and vinegar. Now we know that the gas produced, carbon dioxide, is heavier than air. Since it's heavier in air, you should be able to pour it, much like you pour water. So baking soda and vinegar. Okay, that's sitting there generating carbon dioxide, and we will attempt to pour that. Also, flames don't like carbon dioxide. Characteristics of matter. We'll probably somewhere along the line have a unit on the characteristics of matter. And here we have two test tubes. Both look very similar. Pour it in. It's water.
Actually, it's not. Acid then. Two substances look the same, but quite different properties. One thing that's kind of nice to do in a lab is to produce foam. And I'll tell you, a lot of times when I do chemical experiments, what we do is we spend a lot of time talking about it first. And we'll balance the equations. If it's an upper grade class, we'll balance the equation and talk about what should happen and how it happens and the amounts of reactants and so on. This is also used to show the action of a catalyst. What we're putting in here is hydrogen peroxide. Hydrogen peroxide is water with an extra atom of oxygen tied in. And it's very easy to kick that extra atom of oxygen off the molecule. But the way you can do that is with the catalyst. The catalyst does not change. Put a little bit of soap in here. The catalyst we're going to use in this case is manganese dioxide, or you can use potassium iodide. There's a number of different catalysts you can use to release that extra oxygen. And so we're producing oxygen here. The manganese dioxide will not change as we put it in, but it will release the oxygen from the hydrogen peroxide.
Like to put the soap in.
The soap is what actually creates the foam. The oxygen is coming from the hydrogen peroxide. Otherwise, we just kind of spew out oxygen.
I did the same thing with using iron filings as a catalyst.
Oh, okay.
That would work fast.
With manganese dioxide really soap. Works nicely.
What?
The manganese dioxide does work very nicely to release it. You sure is. If you take a C or D cell and cut it open, the black material in there is manganese dioxide.
So
by the way, I'm using 30% hydrogen peroxide, which makes a big difference. If you use a drugstore variety, I don't think you won't have that happen. Some demonstrations you can do on the overhead projector. This is hardware store variety muriatic acid, better known as hydrochloric acid. And we'll just put a little bit of this in here. No, I have it here. I need acidic thiosulfate. What I use this for often is to show when we're talking about states of matter, looking at colloids as one of those states. And in this particular demonstration, we produce a colloid. So right there is that. At this point, is just straight hydrochloric acid. And I'm going to put in just a few crystals. This is sodium thiosulfate, also known as photographer's hippo. Mix it up a little bit. This is called chemical sunset. What is being produced is a colloid of sulfur. And so as the sulfur is produced, it becomes darker and darker and darker. Now you say, well, what's happening over on the other side?
This is a two tray Petri dish, and the other side I just had a little shallower amount of hydrochloric acid in, but that will get dark as well. Chemical sunset. We're forming a colloid, a suspension of sulfur, pure sulfur, in that.
Most, many of you have probably seen this. This is a chemical volcano. It's often used in students do science fairs. They often use this as their to make the volcano go off. Ammonium dichromate. And you need, all you need to do is light it. It can be a little trick to light. Because I have done it enough to feel terribly cold. It is what I found in one of those chemistry textbooks. It works very, very nicely. Let me just explain what happened. It is, you use iodine crystals, ammonium hydroxide, and you produce, you make a precipitate known as nitrogen triiodide. And nitrogen triiodide is very, very explosive. And I made two little batches of it. As long as it's wet, no problem. As soon as it dries, it becomes very explosive. And we touch the one, as it was drying, I've never messed with this before, this was just a couple of weeks ago. As it was drying, where I thought it was about dry, and I got it back with a stick and was trying to touch the lid, nothing happened. And then one of my students, he came over and he kind of blew on it a little bit. And some of that out around the edge went pop, pop. Oh, just little grains of it. Then the air conditioner cut on and started popping from the air moving from that. Well, I picked the air conditioner off, let the stuff dry a little bit more, and I came back and I touched it with a stick. And I mean, it was really, I went bang, and a nice plume of purple smoke came out. And so I had this other one, and I thought, well, I'll let it dry. Well, I had to leave the school. And so I put it in our lab, and I put it. Sorry about that. I put it in the lab, the middle lab, where I wasn't touching anything. I was nervous. And
you
know, it wasn't. I was scared, sure, quite burned down very quickly. Anyways, I had it there, I locked the lab door, and I went home, and I kept thinking about that thing during the night. In fact, I said something to my wife, I hope the church is still there. And I came back the next morning, and it had blown. It blew. The portion was just small, but I had it pressing on a piece of paper, and that was blown in two pieces. And they were reaching into some of the chemicals gone. And so I thought I would refrain from, until I had a little more experience of doing that today. I should say, though, there really is some value. Now, a lot of the chemical demonstrations, see, I'm not really taking the time to develop them. And that's not good.
Because you don't get a whole lot of value out of them other than the oh, that's neat type of thing. What you want to do with your students is to talk about the chemicals, talk about the type of reactions, talk about how they're reacting, talk about the meanings of catalysts and so on. But there are some benefits just to doing some explosions sometimes. It adds an interest to the students. It's worthwhile. Now here's another one that is often used. This is another decomposition reaction. Just sugar. Sugar, of course, made up of carbon, hydrogen, and oxygen. And we will try to decompose sugar by using sulfuric acid. This is not concentrated sulfuric. This is not concentrated. And so it takes a little bit for the reaction. It takes a little while for the reaction to take place. But the sulfuric acid will decompose the sugar into the carbon with a little time. See, it's starting to turn a black. That's the carbon forming. If we went and did the balanced equation, you can see the products of water is one of the products that comes from this. This, I believe, is 66% sulfuric acid. If you use a higher grade, it will work very quickly. See your way to purchasing a little magnesium for your diet. Strip of magnesium metal, again, useful for showing characteristics, different forms of metal, matter. It's a little difficult to get it started. Oh, Next thing was this. This is called rocket results, and again, it shows spontaneous combustion. It shows an endothermic or an exothermic reaction. If you have two different types of reactions, exothermic, endothermic. In this case, it's exothermic, where it produces quite a bit of heat. Small quantities of this is potassium chloride. You have to be extremely careful with it. Okay, put a little potassium chloride in. Potassium chloride, very much like the hydrogen peroxide, has a lot of extra oxygen, very strong oxygen. It wants to release that oxygen. Okay. Let's get that in, mix those two together. Get it to where it begins to smoke. Some chlorine gas. Now, that is the one. It's not going to produce much, and we're going to keep the lid off. But it is important that if you don't get too much of that, ingest it. But you will smell something. Here we have a little bit of bleach. And we'll put in just household bleach. And then we're going to put some hydrochloric acid in there. It gives us an excess of chlorine ions. And we will begin to produce chlorine gas. Then we'll stick some. We're going to stick some calcium carbide in. Calcium carbide produces acetylene when reacted with water. It is a spontaneous combustion of acetylene. This is a flower bomb. We're not going to demonstrate it. It makes a clear mess. All you need is flour or candle. Now, your flour needs to be dry, but just have a hole in the bottom of this, and there is a, you can see, we just have a funnel in there that we attach to our tube. Light the candle. If your flour is dry, it works beautifully. Light your candle, hook the tube up to the funnel. Fill your funnel full of dry flour, stick the lid on, and get back and blow. And your fine flour, very explosive, blow your lid up, and nice flame is coming out.
The
candle's inside. This one can be a little tricky. The important thing is your flour's dry. If your flour's not dry, it'll just sit there and you blow all that. Nothing happens. Okay, we have one other, two of them. The explosions that we'll do to wind up. And this is the one, by the way, where I burned my hand. But we're going to be using the sulfur rather than the phosphorus today. And we use sulfur and use potassium chloride. So we're just using that rocket exhaust. This is potent stuff. You have to be careful with it. Another way, while I'm waiting on that, just do this. Sulfur can be used to illustrate surface tension pretty nicely. So if you just sprinkle some sulfur, and this is in kind of quads. Now it just lays there along the surface because of the surface tension of the water. And when you bust that surface tension with a little bit of soap, get the sulfur cascades. We'll take equal quantities of potassium chloride and mix it with sulfur. This is what I was doing with phosphorus. The equal quantity to keep it about dime size. And fixing it, but the phosphorus is when I had a spontaneous combustion. And I've never had that happen with me with sulfur. But you don't, you want to be careful not to grind it. But you do want to mix it. Basically, what you're doing here is making a firecracker. But the way we will explode this firecracker is with an impact. Produce hydrogen gas. Of course, we know the hydrogen gas is lighter than air, and so if we fill a balloon full of it, it will float, and it will all, we also know, thanks to the Hindenburg, it's very explosive. And so both of those are really useful for our purposes. Now, I don't think we'll actually go through the process of blowing the balloon up. It's very easy if you just, we use light as the base, strong base, use aluminum foil with it to produce the hydrogen. Sodium hydroxide plus aluminum, you have a single displacement reaction, and you get hydrogen gas released from that. Now, we did that earlier this morning, and we have a balloon. I see that it's starting to go down, but it is floating, and it is full of basically hydrogen. Now, we will see if it is explosive. Somebody have that tape dispenser?
Put on that table.
Oh, okay, very good. Okay, thank you very much. I'm finished.
For the most current Faith Builders recordings, visit ChristianLearning.org. And for more free resources that support teaching and learning, visit the DocForLearning.org.